Welcome to Evidence Based, a New Harbinger psychology podcast. We're your hosts, Cassie and Kendall.
On today's episode, we're talking about otherness. Our guest is Dr. Stacey Reihitzer, a Chicago, Illinois-based transgender counselor, educator, and public speaker for the stories of the bullied, forgotten, and oppressed. The San Antonio native serves as clinical faculty of counseling at Southern New Hampshire University, where she received the Distinguished Faculty Award in 2018. She travels the globe to teach and engage audiences around diverse topics of otherness, self-sabotage, and imposter phenomenon. Hi, Stacey. Thanks so much for joining us. We're really happy to chat with you about such an important topic today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to get into this and share some thoughts about otherness.
Again, as Cassie said, welcome to Evidence Based, Stacey. We're so glad to have you. And we wanted to start the conversation with an establishing question to really define what is otherness and what are some experiences that can be termed other?
Well, otherness is an experience that's very subjective. And what I have come to recognize it as is this thing that happens where we are cast out or bullied or humiliated or isolated or somehow targeted for our differences. And that's a wide range of things, because our differences can mean, of course, something that's very, very specific to us and our physical appearance, something that is a conspicuous scar or something about our body. There is a lot of body shaming that's part of otherness, of course. That's a big part of people's reality. There is a lot of otherness that goes on for people whose differences are more due to things like neurodivergence, because they've got ADHD or they're in the autism spectrum or any other experience of neurodivergence in which their method for processing is something that is not specific to the dominant culture's reference point. And so it strikes others as somehow different and somehow less than, and leads somebody to actively seek to oppress, to bully, to harm them. It's also things that are sometimes very big parts of our identity that are cultural in nature. So certainly otherness is foundational in the sad story of racism and of homophobia and transphobia, of anti-Semitism and Islamophobia, and these experiences of oppressing individuals within a group. And so what I have come to understand otherness as is that distilled set of experiences that we take away of being made to feel different and therefore inferior for these aspects of I am, these things that are just part of me, that are immutable characteristics that are part of my appearance, my culture, my way of moving in and about the world. So, and it's a very, as I said, a subjective experience, because otherness is really how I'm perceiving the world as a result of being cast into this role.
And what are some ways that those who are experiencing that otherness, what are some maybe less conscious ways they're experiencing that?
I think that sometimes when we're going about our experience and we don't always recognize specifically, I'm navigating this. Certainly, I'll speak from my own experience here. I'm a transgender woman, and I'm therefore noticing what it's like right now to be in this space with all of these cisgender people and being the only one who is like me, and that I'm now consciously aware that I'm starting to try and appease them to try and ensure my own safety. But that's, I think, one of those really common things that happens in an unconscious way. We are trying to navigate the world and navigate a dominant culture. And we oftentimes will begin navigating via the method that was set for us by the dominant group. So if the dominant group needs me as a transgender woman to sometimes be outrageous and entertaining to them, or to somehow be the one who is a wise educator or an advocate or something like that, that's an exoticized expectation that they will hold me to. But I also recognize that I often hold myself to, because I'm recognizing that I am moving through a space and needing to somehow play by their rules, and just in order to ensure my safety. I think what happens for us is that we start to try and really just maintain this sense of responsibility to navigate, and it's in doing so we really begin losing touch with our own selves and what we're needing. We start to really experience a lot of mental and emotional and spiritual depletion as a result of having to do this. It is a very tiring thing for anybody who has an experience of otherness to try and move through a space within a dominant group, when I say a dominant group too, I mean a group of people who in our minds resemble our bullies, resemble the people who have oppressed us historically or are actively oppressing our lives right now. And this is certainly a very active social and political climate right now, where we're very conscious of how we're being perceived and how much power people have in our lives. And this is certainly very, very true for people from groups whose experiences are right now being determined by a whole lot of other people. And, you know, I don't know, women, for example. And so, you know, that's a very real thing for us. So how do we navigate the world, and how do we do this? And I think it's such a fascinating thing. And I sometimes consider what it must be like for people who don't ever have to really think about how they navigate so much. They're not really having to consider the role of how they engage oppressive forces or people who represent their bully population or something like that. But it's a very tiring experience. Then I think anybody who has an experience of otherness can understand what that looks like and feels like.
It's like carrying the weight of an entire population because you feel like you're representing for the group. Like, so much pressure.
Yeah, it's a lot of pressure, and it's a lot of because it's an awareness that if I somehow fail in this, if I'm somehow not what I'm expected to be in this role, or if I'm not somehow fulfilling somebody else's needs of me in order to retain their sense of dominance, then I'm somehow failing. And so it's a really fascinating thing, because I think as a result of that, we can actively contribute to this culture of oppression, because we allow our oppressors to stay in place without ever interrogating their own privilege, their own roles and responsibilities in bullying not only us, but in creating a society that has such profound and sometimes violently enforced power hierarchies.
And as we're talking, you mentioned lightly about your journey, and I wanted to talk about your work and your journey and the seven central truths that you found along that you mentioned in your book.
So the seven central truths for me represent these observations that I've made that I think are true by degree for anybody who's moved through this story of otherness. So the first of these, being ostracized, bullied, discriminated against, and forgotten about as a child is a form of shame-based trauma. And the reason I named this as such is because we oftentimes minimize our pain. This is, I think, a real survival strategy for people who have been othered. We minimize these childhood experiences as something that happened to us a long time ago, and I should get past this. And as a result of this, as the result of our emphasis and effort in not naming trauma as it is, I think that we really fail to take appropriate action to be able to really do repair work and to heal these things. And in fact, these experiences stay with us just like other forms of trauma would. If you underwent a really serious accident and you had a leg injury that you didn't ever treat, your leg would forever be impacted by that. It would impact your walking and things like that. You can't just not treat a leg that has, you know, a broken bone or something like that in it, because it's just not going to repair itself on its own. And I think that's a really important a way to recognize what trauma is. And it's the same thing when we talk about these forms of mental and emotional trauma. Otherness and trauma instills a great deal of fear. And that really speaks to my point I made earlier, is this is a lot of fear-based stuff that we carry with us. Oftentimes being bullied, being cast out, being isolated, being humiliated are terrifying experiences. And the recollection of these experiences is itself terrifying. And so what will happen is that when we're in something that that snaps us back to that recollection, the brain will respond to fear. That's really what trauma is. And so the brain is in that moment responding to just the associated memories that come with it. So something that feels similar to what we've been through in the past will be re-triggered. And that's when we see fear re-triggered in these experiences. It doesn't just go away. This is number three. Fear doesn't just go away because we grow up. Rather, it drives home certain false rules that we follow into adulthood. And this is where I think, again, the analogy, if you had trauma to your leg and you didn't repair whatever bone was broken or whatever was dislocated in your leg, then you would start to walk a certain way. You would start to balance your body in a certain way. And that's really what we're talking about that happens here, is that trauma shapes us, and it shapes how we move through the world, how we negotiate relationships, how we engage not only with our culture that represents our oppressors, but also how we engage others who are like us, how we engage even with our own thoughts and our own beliefs about ourselves. There are so many things that are shaped by these experiences of otherness and what we come to believe about ourselves and the world that we live in. The rules of fear show up in many ways throughout our lives, influencing what we believe about ourselves and how we participate in relationships. The observation I've made, and this came from work that I was doing with as a couples therapist, was that it wasn't that people would couple and they would bring all of their stuff with them. And so the realities I encountered were that there were a lot of people with these profound experiences of othering in their histories, and that when they coupled with somebody else who had their own othering, or that maybe played out even a bully dynamic, there's a lot of stuff that shows up then in that relationship. So we can imagine then what that might look like for same gender couples who themselves have experiences of otherness due to their developing queer identity. We can imagine what it's like for two couple members who experienced profound profound racism and profound experiences of racial hatred for their own identity development. These things impact people. They sit with them, and they are influential in our later adult dynamics. Like other forms of trauma, the trauma of otherness can be healed. And this is, I think, one of the things that's the most important to recognize, is that we don't just have to sit with this stuff anymore, and we don't have to just continue to walk around on a broken leg. We don't have to just exist in our relationships from a place of wounding, where we're continually hurting somebody from and doing things that represent our own recreation of the past, we have an opportunity to really begin doing some very intentional healing work from these old places of wounding. And number six, as we heal from our sense of otherness, we can follow a path of mental, emotional, and spiritual freedom. This is, I think, one of the most important things to recognize and claim in healing work, is that when we start changing our path and we're no longer using the dominant group as our compass point, as our point of reference for our lives, and we're no longer being subjugated to old systems of dominance, or, and by that I mean both the dominance that exists outside ourselves and the beliefs that we hold in response to that, then we can really start doing things in a very, very different way. And that it really does free our path. It gives us something that is truly liberating in our story. We get to liberate our own way of engaging with the world and do things in an entirely different way. And when we learn to recognize our distinct life path and experience the vast wonder of our spirit in many dimensions, we can create the life that we deserve. And that's a thing to recognize as a person who is healing otherness. We have things that we truly do deserve. And I think that sometimes we don't always easily recognize that, because I think we're very accustomed to seeing a deserving people and groups as those who othered us, because that was oftentimes very much the message that we received along the way.
I think that last one is especially powerful. And I want to talk about, it feels like at the base of otherness, there are two common threads of fear-based shame and identity-based bullying. And you talk about those in your book. Can you explain what those are?
Sure. Shame is such a powerful force in our lives. And what shame will do is that it will keep us in a path that is entirely restrictive. Shame is the pair of shoes that are two sizes too small, and they're just that we're hobbling along in, trying to, because we're very because of how we believe it's going to help our feet appear. It is something, if that makes sense. So we want to appear a bit smaller, a bit more diminutive. And thus we're containing ourselves in this very restricted way, and it's of course what goes along with that is that's enormously painful. That's really the essence of this, is to recognize that shame snaps us back into this and says put those shoes back on and keep trotting down the road, so that you can be what people need you to be, so that you can. You can pass according to their rules, so that you can not make waves, so that you can do things that others expect of you. That's the message. Because the fear part of it is of, because if I don't, what will happen? If I was to kick off those shoes and if I was to truly just take a different path, the notion of that as a very frightening place is what keeps us restricted. So freedom feels very, very, very frightening. And so the awareness of that, the fear of being free, is what keeps us bound to shame. Identity-based bullying is the experience of being bullied for an aspect of who I name myself to be. I understand myself to be. Find this to be one of those things that's a very pervasive part of our society. It happens in many ways. It happens in both direct and indirect ways. When we see something that is diminished, when we see something that's dismissive of people who have an identity who are specifying, for instance, right now, there is a growing awareness of of gender pronouns, of people using a lot of ways of naming themselves in the world. And there is also always very easy to find something that is attacking of that, attacking of the, you know, of this as something that's just, you know, capitulating to, you know, to these snowflakes. And it's just and it goes back to gender binarism in a very ugly way. The attacks on critical race theory in academia, standard critical race theory is many people recognize, it's a way of simply understanding of the perspective of oppression from the people who experienced it. You know, thus it's a retelling of historical events, of literature, of these various disciplines. It's the application of that, and to be able to look at it and to ultimately say, and how is it that racism has shaped this understanding of education, of the humanities, of art history, of whatever the discipline is. And so the attacks on that are really not just an attack on something like critical race theory or gender pronouns or even on people's dietary choices, on veganism, for example. But it's really an attack on the individuals who are a part of that community. It's an attack on somebody who is a vegan. It's an attack on somebody who uses their gender pronouns. It's an attack on BIPOC people for having a voice, for saying that this isn't quite how things were, and in fact, I've got a right to retell this. It's the antithesis of that. It's the statement that no, you don't. It is the strong reinforcement of old rules of binarism, of gender oppression, of white supremacy, and of just this an entire system of dominance that seeks to control and maintain a specific set of order that ultimately benefits the few.
Earning your continuing education hours doesn't have to be a painful experience. The right course can open your mind to new possibilities, increase your confidence, and hand you powerful tools to transform your clients' lives. Praxis Continuing Education and Training teams up with some of the brightest minds in mental health to provide cutting-edge, evidence-based training for practitioners. You can learn firsthand from experts like Stephen C. Hayes, Kelly Wilson, Robin Walzer, Kirk Strozzel, and many others. Find your next training at praxisCET.com. That's praxisCET.com.
You talk about fear a lot in your book, and you go on to explain the five rules of fear that are instilled by otherness. Would you mind going through each of them? And in your book, you elaborate on how to free yourself from each of them. So could you give us just a little bit of an example of what those five look like and an example of how to free yourself from each?
Sure. And you know, when I want to preface by saying that the reason that I named these as fear is because I look at this and think these are the story that I've seen played out. This is a story played out certainly in my own life. Yeah. And certainly the stories that I've seen us play out in many, many ways. And by us, I mean the collective stories of otherness that have come to me. The first is, you shouldn't complain because others are worse off than you. You shouldn't complain because others are worse off than you. This is a fascinating old, you know, old shaming way story that I think a lot of people grew up with. And it's a message that people have really taken in as an internal message. So this is the voice that we're telling ourselves. This is us telling ourselves that we shouldn't complain because others are worse off than us. And by that, what that's doing is, I'm sitting here in my own pain and feeling really activated today, for example, because a Texas school district pulled the Diary of Anne Frank from its shelves, and so as a transgender Jew, I'm feeling very, very activated by this. and a native Texan, because it's personally very, very frightening to me. Now, what's often the case is that we encounter these moments where our otherness is really, you know, clicking, and we're very conscious of it. I think what people will sometimes do is to say, well, others are worse off than me. Others have it worse than me. I'm not actively being oppressed right now. I'm, you know, that we'll look to people who are in the Ukraine. We'll look to people who are having these terrible cataclysmic events in life and say, well, that's not me right now. So my story isn't so bad. It's not such a bad thing. And when we do that, what happens is that we often don't take action because we're trying to minimize our own story by amplifying somebody else's. So that's a really common strategy that people use in their experiences. The next rule of fear, you better tone it down. And this is one that certainly a lot of gay and transgender people, I think, probably experience. A lot of queer people have told to tone down queerness, tone down visibility of queerness. People of color know what this is. This is there's a story, an ongoing story of the need to tone down references to culture and to ethnicity. And we certainly see how beauty standards drove that, how Hollywood drove that, how so many things drove it to that we were expected to tone down anything that truly differentiated us from the dominant group, the dominant culture in which we existed. The intention, of course, and this is our beliefs then, because these things started from outside of us, but then they became an internal mechanism, an internal set of beliefs that we hold about ourselves. So this is the rule that we tell ourselves: I've got to tone this down, because if I don't, I could be in danger. And the truth is that that still exists for a lot of people in a lot of parts of the world, that they do have to still navigate a world that's very dangerous for them. They do have to operate within that. But the distinction is when that starts to lead us into to diminishing our creativity, diminishing our sense of agency in our lives, because we start completely existing in a toned down way, that really forces us into a very distinct role that we're having to play. And when that role takes over our lives, then it really pushes out a lot of other things that are very important to us. So the next is, you must work twice as hard. And in this is, again, one of those external messages that I think a lot of us internalized. And the message here is, you must work to prove your worth. Now, that means a lot of different things to a lot of people. For the obvious reference for a lot is working at a job where you've got to prove that you're not lazy or flighty or whatever other stereotypes people may have of you, that you can't prove that you have to prove that that you have balance and equanimity, perhaps, that you're not the person who's going to call out sick even when you are, because people expect you to not be a dependable employee. That's, I think, a lot of the message. But there's also this that's very subtle and plays into relationships. For those of us who had experiences where our otherness led us to believe that we are unlovable, many of us have, in order to participate in relationships, learned to work twice as hard because we believed that we needed to, in order to, first of all, to obtain a relationship like it was some sort of goal, and then to maintain and exist within it. We believe that we needed to work twice as hard as our partner. And oftentimes this is not a conscious process, but It is one of those things that we believe we have to do in order to keep the relationship. But that's because we're approaching the relationship from a diminished place, from our, and that's our otherness taking a front and center role in informing who we are and how we must be in order to maintain this. So the next of these is oh, you shouldn't feel resentful. This rule of fear is that is an interesting one, because when we start to notice ourselves just resenting and feeling truly angry, feeling jealous about somebody's experience, that we just immediately seek to quash it, to not have that. Oh, it's just not a good thing. Jealousy and resentment, these are just bad things, and let's you shouldn't feel that way. And we just, anytime we find ourselves saying what we should and shouldn't do, it's always a good indication that we definitely need to lean into it and just to open that up and look deep in there and just explore it. Where I say this is an important thing is because if I've got, let's say, resentment for somebody whom I view as more privileged than I, somebody who has things that I don't have, this is a great opportunity for me to move into and explore what is this trying to tell me? What am I really needing for my life? Where is this resentment of this person really guiding me? Because resentment itself, if we can just recognize emotions and not judge them, but just see that they're there for a specific reason, and in this case, they're telling us things that we're needing. And if that can be a source of real clarity. And that's what I want people to be able to recognize here, is that this is that resentment with jealousy, these ugly feelings that feel gross inside, once we can acknowledge them, then we can follow their path and see what it is we truly need for ourselves in order to begin liberating our experience, so that person that we were previously experiencing resentment of is no longer our reference point. And the final of these is you cannot change the world. And this is one of these things that I think is an easy place to go, particularly when we're despairing over just many sad changes, many things that just feel that we feel helpless to present to do something different with. We see a rolling back of social policies. We see laws that are becoming suddenly more restrictive. We see things that are changing in our world, and it's very difficult to maintain a sense of optimism in the where our otherness will often take us is to a place of diminished worth, of just helplessness. And what I suggest instead is that we can really recognize these, if we can recognize this tendency, then we can counter it by working to exist in spaces where in fact we do have change agency, that we really find those communities, that we reach out to others, that we seek out the other people who are suffering along with us and lift each other up, to make a decision to no longer suffer. If we can carve out spaces in our lives that can create an exception to this, that can perturb the tendency to just spiral into depression, then we have an ability to keep ourselves from really sinking, from moving into hopelessness. Because the worst thing we can do in a world that we live in right now is to be mired in despair and isolation. Isolation is the last thing that any of us are needing right now. We need to be able to forge community. We need to be able to talk about what's going on for us. And we need to together arrive at spaces for solution and change.
I think that's a great summary too, because the isolation is really the worst thing, and moving toward healing is really important. And so as someone's working through their healing journey from healing from otherness, why is self-compassion such a huge part of that work?
So often we're really so hard on ourselves. We're hard on ourselves when we don't do things perfectly the first time. And I think when we start trying to heal otherness and these tendencies, when we have these moments where we're just not doing something perfectly, that's our own otherness talking again. This thing is just so pervasive. And the thing I've want to impress upon people is the need to go easy on ourselves as we're doing any kind of healing work, any kind of anything. And it's interesting. I was on a trip. I arrived at Heathrow from Chicago, and Heathrow is a confusing airport. It's vast, and I'm gonna hop on a bus, and it just was confusing. And what I noticed was that my first tendency was to kind of begin berating myself. Oh, I should have gone that direction. That's where I needed to go, and I should have gotten on that one. I should have done this, and I started to really notice that. And then I began to just observe how that tendency would have been there. And then I also observed as well, because I've done so much self-compassion work, I don't know Heathrow. I don't live in London. I don't come here all the time. So this isn't familiar to me. It's okay for me to bumble around a bit while I'm trying to find my way. And that's a really good way to be able to just move through life and to say, I'm going to go easy on myself. I'm not going to expect myself to know how to do things the first time. I'm not going to expect myself to not be exhausted, to not be needing something at times. I'm not going to get mad because I've got ugly feelings and jealousy comes up again after I've done a lot of jealousy work, for example. These are things to really get it to practice with and to practice gently. That's the best thing I've really learned to do is just to be gentle with myself and realize, sometimes this is going to happen. Sometimes it's not. I'm going to just be easy here. And particularly with creative work, because I do a lot of it, but I also have got to, I've learned to trust creativity. Creativity is there when it's there. And if it's not there, I'm just not going to force it, but I'm certainly not going to shame myself for not being creative in a moment, because that's not going to make me more creative. I'm just going to go ahead and give in to the need for rest or just the need for an easy distraction, as the case may be, and trust that creativity will return gracefully when I let go of the expectation that I have to be creative. And that it's just a phenomenal experience to be able to go easy and to really just be so much more loving to this complex, creative, fun, silly being that we are.
In almost every interview we've done, anxiety, depression, perfectionism, self-compassion always comes up because it's such a massive part of the journey, especially when we're having these conversations about dealing with inner critics or things of that nature. And as we're talking kind of in the solutions or more in the healing journey, I want to talk about what your opinion was on finding your own community and how that can be so healing, or, how would someone go about seeking out a community in the sense of healing from otherness?
Well, I love this question. The thing that we oftentimes underplay is how important it is to have our pack, to have our place where we really feel trusting and trusted, where we can walk down the street and feel not only just safe, but feel a sense of connection with those around us, that we can be in these spaces where our spirit is liberated. And the way I think a person has to be able to do this is to really just examine and just spend a moment in silence and just noticing what's the yearning I have for people? What if I was to be surrounded by people, what qualities would they need to have? What do I want to have? Who do I want to be among? What do I need to be able to discover? And I think if we can start doing that and start really picturing the qualities of the people that we need to have, and we can start with people in our lives, you know, if we've got the people who are there, if we've got family and friends that are, or loved ones that we're close to, we can look at them and say, you know, this is wonderful. And how can I really build on this? How can I have more of this stuff? You know, more of these kind of people. Or we can look at some of their qualities and say, I like this, but not that. I'd like a community of people who are better listeners, you know, who don't need to talk constantly, or who every time I've got a part of my life that I bring up, don't just immediately segue into a story of their own without actually hearing me. Or do I need a group of people who are creative in order to foster my own creativity? Do I need people for my own culture, my own identity? You know, what are the shared beliefs that I want to have around me? These are things that are really very, very important. And I have come to realize that in the past couple of years, personally, I live in Chicago, in the neighborhood that was formerly called Boys Town, more inclusively is now called North Halsted, a neighborhood, the most diverse neighborhood or something like that. Anyway, so anyway, they changed it to make it more inclusive, and it's cool. So, what I like about it is, and I never realized until I was here how important it is for me just to be able to walk around and to be among queer people. In my entire life, I've never been able to walk into spaces where I would routinely see other transgender people. And now I do, where I see same gender couples holding hands, where I see visible indications of queerness everywhere, where I can actually exist as a queer person and as a queer Jew. This is so important to me to be able to be in spaces where I feel safe and where I feel a sense of community and identity. So these are the ways that I think we have to be able to just register what's important to me. Who do I need to be among? Who are my folks, and what qualities they possess? And maybe it's something that's very specific cultural markers. Maybe it is something that's more based in. And their traits, their hobbies, their characteristics, their emotional intelligence, any of those kinds of things. And that's the things that I think we have to really lean into. And the more that we can do that, the more we'll be able to really build the relationships that we're needing for our lives and de-isolate ourselves.
I love that. That's really important. And as we start to sort of wrap up here, what would you say to someone who's beginning their journey of healing from otherness?
The thing I would say, and the thing I do say, is just go easy on yourself as you do this. I think this goes back to the point of compassion. Create spaces of intentional silence that are for you. And when I say that, spaces where your mind can just be silent. It's a place where you're not having to be distracted by multiple sources of input. And I think that's a much more challenging thing today because more and more it's very difficult for people to focus on any one thing. We're terrible monotaskers. I see how often, you know, people have something that they're watching on television, and they're also looking at their phone, or they're, you know, and there's just multiple sensory inputs. And that's really, hard on the mind. We need to have these intentional places of retreat so that we can do this, and that we can really be loving on ourselves, loving toward ourselves. Another piece to this is as good ideas and things come to us, just trusting the creative process that emerges, And then having the sass to move forward with whatever we recognize that's real. There's so many real parts to the story that I think people have to have time to listen to. And if we can listen to this and we can recognize there's truly an audacious spirit that's within me, and I know that it's yearning to be more free and to be more among those who are musically inclined and to spend more time just existing in a world of music, whatever that might look like, that's a great thing. Then being very intentional in creating that as a way of being is so fundamentally important. And that's, I think, what starts breaking our own experiences of otherness.
I think that's a great place to wrap up, Stacey. I think that was said really beautifully. And I appreciate all of your thoughts from your book, from your work, and your advice, especially as we touch on a very, very important important subject. I know our audience will get a lot of value from your expertise.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's been a great topic, and I really appreciate you all so much for your just the gentleness of your questions, your presence, your just beautiful souls, and it's a real blessing to be with you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
In the Healing Otherness Handbook, Dr. Stacey Reihetzer, a nationally known transgender psychotherapist and expert on trauma, otherness, and self-sabotage, shares her own personal story of childhood bullying and how it inspired her to help others heal from the same wounds. Drawing from mindfulness-based cognitive behavioral therapy, Reihetzer will help you gain a better understanding of how past trauma has limited your life and show you the keys to freeing yourself from self-defeating, destructive beliefs. If you're ready to heal from the past, find power in your difference, and live an authentic life full of confidence, this handbook will help guide you step by step. Visit our website at www.newharbinger.com and use coupon code PODCAST25 to receive 25% off your entire order.
New Harbinger Publications is an independent, employee-owned publisher of books on psychology, health, spirituality, and personal growth. For nearly 50 years, our evidence-based self-help books and pioneering workbooks have helped readers make positive changes to improve mental health and well-being. Founded by psychologists Matthew McKay and Patrick Fanning, New Harbinger is proud to be an employee-owned company. Our books reflect our core values of integrity, sustainability, compassion, and trust. Written by leaders in the field and recommended by therapists worldwide, New Harbinger books are practical, accessible, and provide real tools for real change.
Join the New Harbinger Clinicians Club, a free membership club exclusively for mental health professionals. Sign up today and you'll receive a special welcome gift, 35% off all professional books, free client resources, free ebooks throughout the year, access to private sales, a subscription to our Quick Tips for Therapists email program, and more. Visit newharbinger.com/clinicians-club for more information.
If you enjoyed today's episode, we'd love if you rated, reviewed, and subscribed to the show, and we hope you might share it with anyone who might benefit from the content. This podcast is not a substitute for counseling with a licensed provider.